Some were open to the sky, as this one was. Others were roofed in stone or in shimmering lights. But of them all, this one alone was topped by a thin spire. Below the hundreds of towers, bridges arched through the sky, connecting them. And farther down could be seen the bulk of the single incredible building that supported all he saw. It was a monster of construction. Sprawling below him, it stretched away for miles in every direction. He had known it would be a large place from his travels within, but this knowledge did nothing to lessen his awe at the sight. Still farther down, in the dim extreme of his vision, he could see the faint green of grass, a thin border edging the dark bulk of the building. On all sides he saw water, the once-glimpsed lake. In the distance he could make out the hazy suggestion of mountains, but unless he strained to see them, it was as if the entire world were arrayed below. Plodding upward, he turned around the spire as he climbed. Each circle brought him a new detail of the vista. A single bird wheeled high above all else, ignorant of the affairs of men, its scarlet wings spread to catch the air as it watched with keen eye the lake below. Seeing a telltale flicker on the water, it folded back its wings and stooped, hitting the surface for the briefest moment before it climbed aloft once more, a flopping prize clutched in its talons. With a cry of victory, it circled once, then sped westward. A turn, a play of winds. Each carried suggestions of far and alien lands. From the south, a gust with a hint of hot jungles where slaves toiled to reclaim farmlands from deadly, water-shrouded marshes. From the east, a breeze carried the victory chant of a dozen warriors of the Turil Confederation after defeating an equal number of Empire soldiers in a border clash. In counterpoint, there was a faint echo of a dying Surani soldier crying for his family. From the north came the smell of ice and the sound of the hooves of thousands of Thune pounding over the frozen tundra, heading south for warmer lands. From the west, the laughter of the young wife of a powerful noble, teasing a half-terrified, half-aroused household guard into betraying her husband, away conducting business with a merchant in Tucson to the south. From the east, the smell of spices as merchants haggled in the market square in far Yankora. Again south, and the smell of salt from the Sea of Blood. North, and wind-swept ice fields that had never known the tread of human feet, but over which beings old and wise in ways unknown to men walked, seeking a sign in the heavens, one that never came. Each breeze brought a note and tone, a color and hue, a taste and fragrance. The texture of the world blew by, and he breathed deeply, savoring it. A turn. From the steps below came a pulsing as the world beat with a life of its own. Upward through the island, through the building, through the tower, the spire, and his very body, came the urgent yet eternal beating of the planet's heart. He cast his eyes downward and saw deep caverns, the upper ones worked by slaves who harvested the few rare metals to be found, along with coal for heat and stone for building. Below these were other caverns, some natural, others the remnants of a lost city, overblown by dust that became soil as the ages passed. Here once dwelled creatures beyond his ability to imagine. Deeper still his vision plunged him, to a region of heat and light, where primeval forces contested. Liquid rock, inflamed and glowing, pushed against its solid cousin, seeking a passage upward, mindlessly driven by nature. Deeper still, to a world of pure force, where lines of energy ran through the heart of the world. A turn, and he stepped upon a small platform atop the spire. It was less than his own height in size on each side, an impossibly precarious perch. He stepped to the middle, overcoming a vertigo that tried to send him screaming over the edge. He employed every part of his ability and training to stand there, for he understood without being told that to fail here was to die. He cleared his mind of fear and looked around at the scene before him, awed by the expanse of emptiness. Never before had he felt so truly isolated, so truly alone. Here he stood with nothing between him and whatever fate was allotted to him. Below him stretched the world, and above him an empty sky. The wind held a hint of moisture, and he saw dark clouds racing up from the south. The tower, or the needle upon it, swayed slightly, and he unconsciously shifted his weight to compensate. Lightning flashed as the storm clouds rushed toward him, and thunder broke around his head. The very sound was enough to dislodge him from the small platform, and he was forced to delve deeper into his inner well of power, into that silent place known only as Wall. And there he found the strength to resist the onslaught of the storm. Winds buffeted him, slamming him toward the platform's edge. He reeled and recovered, the darkling abyss below beckoning to him, inviting his fall. With a surge of will, he brushed aside the vertigo once again and set his mind to the task ahead. In his mind, a voice cried, "Now is the time of testing. Upon this tower you must stand, and should your will falter, from it you will fall." There was a momentary pause. Then the voice cried once more, "Behold, witness and understand how it was." Blackness swept upward, and he was consumed. For a time he floats, nameless and lost. A pinpoint of flickering consciousness, an unknown swimmer through a black and empty sea. Then a single note invades the void. It reverberates, a soundless sound, a sense-lacking intruder on the senses. "Without senses, how is their perception?" his mind asks. His mind. "I am," he cries, and a million philosophies cry out in wonder. "If I am, then what is not me?" he wonders. An echo replies, "You are that which you are, and not that which you are not." "An unsatisfactory answer," he muses. "Good," replies the echo. "What is that note?" he asks. "It is the touch of an old man's sleep the moment before death." "What is that note?" "It is the color of winter." "What is that note?" "It is the sound of hope." "What is that note?" "It is the taste of love." "What is that note?" "It is an alarm to wake you." He floats. Around him swim a billion stars. Great clusters drift by, ablaze with energy. In riots of color they spin, giant reds and blues, the smaller oranges and yellows, and the tiny reds and whites. The colorless and angry black ones drink in the storm of light around them, while others pulse out energies in an unknown spectrum. And a few twist the fabric of space and time, sending his vision swimming as he tries to fathom their passing. From each to each a line of force stretches, binding them all in a net of power. Back and forth along the strands of this web energy flows, pulsing with a life that is not life. The stars know, as they fly by, They are aware of his presence, but acknowledge it not. He is too small for them to be concerned with. Around him stretches away the whole of the universe. At various points in the web, creatures of power rest or work, each different from the others, but all somehow the same. Some he can see are gods, for they are familiar to him, and others are less or more. Each plays a role. Some regard him, for his passing is not without notice. Some are beyond him, too great to comprehend him, and so being are less than he. Others study him closely, weighing his power and abilities against their own. He studies them in return. All are silent. He speeds among the stars and the beings of power, until he espies a star, one among the multitude, but one that calls to him. From the star, 20 lines of energy lead away, and near each is a being of power. Without knowing why, he understands that here are the ancient gods of Keliwan. Each plays on the nearest line of power, influencing the structure of space and time nearby. Some contest among themselves. Others work oblivious to the strife. And still others do nothing that is discernible. He moves closer. A single planet swings about the star. A blue and green sphere shrouded in white clouds. Keliwan. Down the lines of force he plunges until he is on the surface. Here he sees a world untouched by the footprint of man. Great beasts with 6 legs stride the land, and hiding from them are a young race of quick-thinking beings. The Choja, a few bands of scurrying creatures, little more than the large insects that spawn them, speed through the trees of the great forests, fearing the large predators who hunt them, as they in turn hunt smaller game. They have begun to reason, and their queens now design each for a specific purpose, so strong and well-armed soldiers protect the foragers. More food is brought to the hive, and the race begins to prosper. Over the plains, the young Thune males race, fighting among themselves with rocks and sticks, fists and fang. They clash, knowing only there is a nameless urge driving them on, demanding that one or another from their band drive off the others and sire the next generation of young. It will be ages before they become reasoning beings, able to work together against the 2-legged creatures who have yet to appear upon this world. Near the sea, not yet named for the blood of thousands killed upon it, the sun huddle on the shore, newly emerged from the sea, discomforted upon the land, but no longer able to abide in the deep. Fearing all, they plot in their sea caves, seeking security and building an attitude toward outsiders that will set the stage for their genocide generations later. Above the mountains, the Thrill-Ill-Ill soar, their culture formative and crude, only little more than a loose association of breeding pairs and young. Their large but delicate wings cast shadows that hide the Num-Mongnum, who creep along the edge of the rocks, hidden from sight by their mottled fur, which resembles the stones behind which they scurry, seeking Thrill-Ill-Ill eggs, beginning a war that will last 1,000 years and end in the annihilation of both races. This is a harsh world, abundant with life, but contentious life, with no mercy for the weak. Of those races he sees, only 2 will endure, the Thune and the Choja. He sees darkness approaching like a sudden storm, and it sweeps over him. Like the calm after the storm, light comes. He stands on a cliff looking down upon a great plain of grass separated from the sea by a small beach. A shimmering in the air begins, and the sea beyond the plain is distorted. Like the agitation of the air by the heat of the day, the scene ripples. Scintillating colors appear in the air. Then, as if by two giant hands, the very fabric of space and time is torn, an ever-widening gap through which he can see. Beyond this fracture in the air, a vision of chaos is revealed, a mad display of energy, as if all the lines of power in that universe are torn asunder. Bolts of energy sufficient to destroy suns explode in displays of color beyond the ability of mortal eyes to describe, leaving them dazzled with lesser lights. From deep within this giant rift, a wide bridge of golden light extends downward until it touches the grass of the plain. Upon the bridge, thousands of figures are moving, escaping the madness beyond the rift to the serenity of the plain. Downward they hurry, some carrying all they own on their backs, others with animals pulling wagons and sleds heaped with valuables. All press forward, fleeing a nameless horror behind. He studies the figures, and though much is alien, he can see much that is also familiar. Many wear short robes of plain fashion, and he knows he is looking upon the seeds of the Surani race. Their faces are more basic, showing less of the blending with others that would take place in years to come. Most are fair, with brown or blonde hair. At their feet run barking dogs, sleek and swift greyhounds and whippets. Next to them stride proud warriors with slanted eyes and bronze skin. These are fighting men, but not organized soldiers, for they wear robes of different cut and color one from the other. Each steps down off the bridge, some showing wounds, all hiding terror behind implacable expressions. Over their shoulders they carry long swords of fine steel, fashioned with great care. The tops of their heads are shaved, with the hair around pulled back into a knot. These bear the proud look of men unsure if they are better off for having survived the battle. Mixed among them are others, all strangers. A race of short people carry nets that proclaim them fishers, though of what sea only they know. They have dark hair, sallow skin, and grey-green eyes. Men, women, and children all wear simple fur trousers, leaving upper bodies bare. Behind them come a nation of tall, noble, black-skinned people. Their robes are richly fashioned of soft and subtle colors. Many have gems adorning their foreheads and gold bands on their arms. All are weeping for a homeland never to be seen again. Then come riders upon impossible beasts that look like flying serpents with feathered birds' heads. Upon the riders' faces are masks of animals and birds, brightly painted and plumed. They are covered in paint alone, for their homeworld was a hot place. They wear their nakedness like a cloak, for there is beauty in their form, as if each had been fashioned by a master sculptor, and they bear weapons of black glass. Women and children ride behind the men unmasked, revealing expressions made harsh by the cruel world they flee. The serpent riders turn their creatures eastward and fly away. The great flying snakes will die out in the cold highlands of the east, but will remain forever in the legends of the proud Turil. Thousands more come, all walking down the golden ramp to set foot upon Keliwan. When they reach the plain, some move off, traveling to other parts of the planet, but many stay and watch as thousands more come across the bridge. Time passes. Night follows day, then gives way to day once more, while the hosts enter from the insane storm of chaos. With them come 20 beings of power, also fleeing the utter destruction of a universe. The multitudes upon the plain cannot see them passing, but he can. He knows they will become the 20 gods of Keliwan, the 10 higher and 10 lower beings. They fly upward, to wrest the lines of power from the ancient feeble beings who hold station around this world. There is no struggle as the new gods take their stations, for the old beings of power know a newer order is coming into the world. After days of watching, he sees that the stream of humanity is thinning. Hundreds of men and women pull huge boats made from some metal, shining in the sun, mounted on wheels of a black substance. They reach the plain and see the ocean beyond the narrow beach. They give a shout and pull their boats to the water and launch them. 50 boats raise sail and set out across the ocean, heading southward. For the land that will become Subar, the lost nation. The last group is composed of thousands of men in robes of many designs and colors. He knows that these are the priests and magicians of many nations. Together they stand, holding back the raging madness beyond. As he watches, many fall, their lives burning out like spent candles. At some prearranged signal, many of them, but less than one for each 100 standing at the top of the golden bridge, turn and flee downward. All are holding books, scrolls, and other tomes of knowledge. When they reach the bottom of the bridge, they turn and watch the unfolding drama at the top. Those above, looking not at those who have fled but at what they hold back, give forth a shout, incanting a mighty spell, wielding magic of enormous power. Those below echo their cries, and all who can hear them quail in dread at the sound. The bridge begins to dissolve from the ground up. A flood of terror and hate comes pouring through the rift, and those who stand atop the bridge begin to crumple before its onslaught. As the bridge and the opening above disappear from sight, a single blast of fury comes through that stuns many who stand upon the plain below, felling them as if with a blow. For some time, those who escaped the nameless terror behind the rift stand mute. Then slowly they start to disperse. Groups break away and move off. He knows that, in years to come, these ragged refugees will conquer this world, for they are the seeds of the nations that populate Kelywan. He knows he has seen the beginning of the nations and their flight from the enemy, the nameless terror that destroyed the homes of the races of mankind, dispersing them to other universes. Again the cloak of time is drawn over him, creating darkness, followed by light. On the plain that had been empty, a great city stands. Its white towers ascend to the skies. Its people are industrious, and the city prospers. Caravans of trade goods come overland, and great ships call from across the sea. Years speed by, bringing war and famine, peace and bounty. One day a ship pulls into the harbor, as scarred and ill as its crew. A great battle has been fought, and this ship is one of the few to survive. Those across the water will come soon, and the city of the plains will fall if help is not forthcoming. Runners are sent north to the cities along the great river, for should the white city fall, nothing will prevent the invaders from striking northward. Runners return, carrying the news. The armies of the other cities will come. He watches as they gather and meet the invaders near the sea. The invaders are repulsed, but the cost is great, for the battle rages 12 days. 100,000 men die, and the sands are red for months. 1,000 ships burn, and the sky is filled with black smoke, and for days it falls upon the land, covering miles about with a fine, powdery ash. The city of white becomes the city of grey. The sea is called blood from that day forward, and the great bay is called battle. But out of the battle an alliance is formed, and the seeds of the great empire are planted, The world-spanning empire of Suran Uwani. Like silence descending, darkness comes. As a clarion sounding, light returns. He stands atop a temple in the heart of the central city of the empire. Below, thousands of people stand. Shoulder to shoulder, they fill the streets, chanting while thousands of upraised hands pass along great wooden platforms overhead. Upon the platform stand the nobles of the empire, lords of the five great families. Upon the last platform, largest of all, rests a golden throne, fashioned from the rarest of metals of this mineral-poor world. Upon this throne sits a young boy. When the platform reaches the great square of the 20 higher and lower guards, it is placed upon the ground, and the throne is carried on the backs of the citizens to the top of the highest temple. The throne is lowered, facing southeast, from where the nations had come in the beginning. From deep within the temple, a dozen black-clad priestesses rush forth, red-clad priests at their side. The priestesses of Sibi, the death goddess, point out one or another citizen in the crowd, and the red-clad priests of the killing god grab them. They seize men, women, and occasionally children. All are dragged to the top of the temple, where waiting priests of the red god cut their hearts from their bodies, while the priests and priestesses of the other 18 orders look on silently. When hundreds have been sacrificed, and the temple steps are bathed in blood, the chief priestess of the death goddess judges the gods satisfied. They place a silver ring upon the boy's hand, and a golden circlet upon his brow, and proclaim him the light of heaven, Minjochka, 11 times emperor. The boy plays with a wooden toy given to him at the start of the day, for he grows bored easily, while the throng presses forward to dip their hands in the blood of their countrymen, counting it lucky to do so. In the east, the sky darkens as night approaches. As the sun rises, he stands near a magician who has worked the night through. The man grows alarmed at what his calculations have shown, and he incants a spell that takes him to another place. The watcher follows. In a small hall, several more magicians react with expressions of dread to the news the first magician brings. A messenger is dispatched to the warlord, ruler of the empire, in the emperor's name. The warlord summons the magicians. The watcher follows. The magicians explain the news. The signs in the stars, along with ancient writings, herald the coming of a great disaster. A star, a wanderer in the heavens sighted where none has been seen before, stands motionless but grows brighter. It will bring destruction to the nations. The warlord is skeptical, but of late more and more nobles have come to heed the words of magicians. There have always been legends of magicians saving the nations from the enemy, but few think them likely. Still, there is now this new convocation of magicians who have formed something called the Assembly, toward what ends only the magicians know. So, with the changing times in mind, the warlord agrees to take the news to the emperor. After a time, an order is sent to the Assembly by the emperor. His demand? Bring proof. The magicians shake their heads and return to their modest halls. Decades pass, and the magicians conduct a campaign of propaganda, seeking to influence any noble of the empire who will listen. The day arrives when the news is proclaimed that the emperor is dead and his son now reigns. The magicians gather with all who can travel to the holy city for the coronation of the new emperor. Thousands of people line the streets, while slaves bear the nobles of the land in litters to the great temples. The new emperor rides the ancient golden throne, borne by 100 husky slaves. He is crowned, while a slave is sacrificed deep within the halls of the temple of the death god, Turakamu, as a petition to the gods to allow the old emperor's soul to rest in heaven. The crowd cheers, for Sudkahan Choza, 34 times emperor, is well-loved, and this will be the last time they will ever look upon him. He will now retire to the Holy Palace, where his soul will stand forever vigilant on behalf of his subjects, while the warlord and the High Council conduct the business of governing the empire. The new emperor will live a contemplative life, reading, painting, studying the great books of the temples, seeking to purify his soul for this arduous life. This emperor is unlike his father and, after hearing the grave news from the assembly, orders the building of a great castle upon an island in the center of the giant lake in the midst of the mountains of Ambalina. Time passes. Hundreds of black-clad magicians stand atop towers that rise from the city of the island, not yet the magnificent single entity of the future. 200 years have passed, and now 2 suns burn in the sky, one warm and yellow-green, the other small, white, and angry. The watcher sees the men work their magic, the greatest spell cast in the history of the nations. Even the legendary bridge from the outside, the beginning of time, was not so great a feat, for then they had only moved between worlds. Now they would move a star. Below he can feel the presence of hundreds of other magicians, adding their power to those above. The spell has been wrought over the last few years, each step taken with the greatest care as the stranger approaches. Though powerful beyond compare, this enchantment is also delicate in the extreme. Any misstep, and its work will be undone. He looks up and sees the stranger, its course marked toward the path of this world. It will not strike Keliwan, but there is little doubt that its heat, added to Keliwan's already hot star, will render the planet lifeless. Keliwan will hang for over a year between its own primary and the stranger, in constant daylight, and all magicians agree that only a few might survive in deep caves to emerge to a burned-out planet. Now they must act, before it is too late to try again, should the enchantment fail. Now they do act, all in concert, incanting the last piece of the great arcane work. The world seems to stand still for a moment, reverberating with the final word of the spell. Slowly that reverberation grows louder, picking up resonance, developing new harmonies, new overtones, a character of its own. Soon it is loud enough to deafen those in the towers who cover their ears. Below, those on the ground stand in mute wonder, looking to the sky where a blaze of color begins to form. Ragged bolts of energy flash, and the light from the 2 stars is dimmed in momentarily blinding displays that will leave some who viewed them sightless for the rest of their lives. He is not affected by the sound or light, as if some agency has taken care to protect him from their effects. A great rift appears in the sky, much like the one the Golden Bridge came through ages ago. He watches without emotion, his strongest feeling being detached fascination. It grows in the sky, between the stranger and Keliwan, and begins to move away from the planet toward the invading star. But something else occurs. From the heart of the rift, more violent than at the time of the Golden Bridge, an unprecedented display of erupting energies comes forth. The chaotic scene is matched with an overwhelming wave of hatred. The enemy, the evil power that drove the nations to Keliwan, still abides in the other universe, and it has not forgotten those who escaped it ages ago. It cannot pierce the barrier of the rift, for it needs more time to move between universes than the lifespan of the rift. But it reaches forth and warps it, sending it away from the stranger. The rift grows larger, and those on the ground see it is going to engulf Kelywan, bringing the planet back into the dominion of the enemy. The Watcher looks on impassively, unlike those around him, for he knows that this is not the end of the world. The rift rushes toward the planet, and one magician comes forth. He is somehow familiar to the one who watches. The man, unlike those around him, wears a brown robe, fastened round with a whipcord belt, and holds a staff of wood. He raises the staff above his head and incants. The rift changes, from colors impossible to describe, to inky black, and it strikes the planet. The heavens explode for a moment, then all around is black. When the darkness lifts, the sun, Kelywan's own, is dropping below the horizon. The magicians who are not dead or mad stare upward in horror. Above them the sky is a void without stars. And the man in brown turns to him and says, "Remember, things are not always what they seem." Blackness heralds the passing of time again. He is standing in the halls of the assembly. Magicians are appearing regularly, using the pattern on the floor as a focal point for their transit. Each remembers the pattern like an address, and wills himself there. A message arrives from the Emperor. He begs the assembly to solve the problem, promising them whatever aid they require. The Watcher moves forward through generations to find the magicians again upon the towers. Now, instead of the invading stranger, they regard a starless sky. Another spell, years in the fashioning, is being incanted. When it is finished, the earth reverberates with violent energies. Suddenly the sky is ablaze with stars, and Kelywan is again in its normal place. "Things are not always what they seem," says a voice. The Emperor sends a command that the full assembly should come to the holy city at once. By ones and twos they use the patterns to travel to Kentosani. The Watcher follows. There they are taken to the inner chamber of the Emperor's palace, something unheard of in the history of the Empire. Of the 7,000 magicians who gathered a century before to thwart the stranger, only 200 survived. Even now that number has increased but slightly, so that not even one magician for each 20 who stood upon towers against the stranger answers the Emperor's call. They advance to stand before Tukamako, 40 times Emperor, descendant of Sutka Hanchosa, and Light of Heaven. The Emperor asks if the assembly will accept the charge to stand ever vigilant over the Empire, protecting it until the end of time. The magicians confer and agree. The Emperor then leaves his throne and abases himself before the assembled magicians, something never done before. He sits back and, still on his knees before them, throws wide his arms and proclaims that from this day forth the magicians are the great ones, free from all obligations, save the charge just accepted. They are outside the law, and none may command them, including the warlord, who stands to one side, a frown upon his face. Whatever they desire is theirs to ask, for their words will be as law. And a magician smiles knowingly at another nearby. Darkness. And time passes. The Watcher stands before the warlord's throne. A delegation of magicians stands before the warlord. They present him with proof of what they have claimed. A controllable rift, free from the enemy's influence, has been opened, and another world has been found. This is unsuitable for life. But a second has been discovered, a rich, ripe world. They show him a lifetime's worth of wealth in metals, all found lying about, discarded. He who watches smiles to himself over the warlord's eagerness at the sight of a broken breastplate, a rusted sword, and a handful of bent nails. To further prove this is an alien world, they present him with a strange but beautiful flower. The warlord smells it, and is pleased with its rich fragrance. The watcher nods, for he, too, knows the richness of a Midkemian rose. The black wing of passing time covers him again. Once more he stood upon the platform. He looked around and saw that the full fury of the storm was breaking around him. Only by his unconscious will had he been able to stand upon this platform, while his conscious mind was occupied by the unfolding history of Kelewan. He now understood the nature of the test, for he found himself exhausted from the energy he had expended during the ordeal. While being instilled with the final instruction in his place in this society, he had been tested with the raw fury of nature. He took a last look around, finding the grim view of the storm-tossed lake and the shuttered windows of the tower somehow satisfying. He strove to capture this image, as if to ensure that he would forever remember the moment he came to his full awakening as a great one, for there were no more blocks on his memory or his emotions. He exulted in his power. No longer Pug the keep boy, but now a magician of power to dwarf the imagination of his former master, Colgan. And never again would either of these worlds, Midkemia or Kelewan, seem the same to him. By force of will, he descended to the roof, floating gently through the raging wind. The door opened in anticipation of his coming. He entered, and it closed behind him. Shimon was waiting for him, a smile upon his face. As they moved down the long halls of the assembly building city, the skies outside exploded with clashes of thunder, as if heralding his arrival. Ocho Pepper sat upon his mat, awaiting the arrival of his guest. The heavy, bald magician was interested in gauging the mettle of the newest member of the assembly, come into his estate as a wearer of the black robe the previous day. A chime sounded, announcing his guest's arrival. Ocho Pepper stood and crossed his richly furnished apartment. He pulled aside the sliding door.
"Welcome, Milamba. I am pleased you saw fit to accept my invitation."
"I am honored," was all Milamba said as he entered and regarded the room. Of all the quarters in the assembly building he had seen, this was by far the most opulent. The hangings on the walls were rich cloth, enhanced with the finest threadwork, and there were several valuable metal objects adorning various shelves. Milamba made a study of his host as well. The heavy-set magician showed Milamba to a cushion before a low table, and then poured cups of chokcha. His plump hands moved with controlled ease, precisely and efficiently. His dark, nearly black eyes shone from under the thick brows that accented an otherwise deceptively bland face. He was the stockiest magician Milamba had seen yet, as most who wore the black robe tended to be thin and ascetic-looking. Milamba sensed this was largely by design, as if someone occupied with the pleasures of the flesh couldn't be too concerned with matters of deep thought. After the first sip of chocha had been taken, Ocho Pepper said,
"You pose something of a problem for me, Milamba."
When Milamba made no comment, Ocho Pepper said, "You make no remark." Milamba inclined his head in agreement.
Perhaps your background accounts for a bit more wariness than is the rule here. Malamba said, A slave become magician is something to ponder. Hucho Pepper waved his hand. It is a rarity for a slave to don the black robe, but not unheard of. Occasionally the power is not recognized until adulthood. But the laws are explicit, and no matter how late the power is revealed, nor how mean the station of the man manifesting it, from that instant on he is subject only to the assembly. Once a soldier was ordered hanged by his lord, he floated, suspended in space, a scant hair's breadth from hanging by sheer power of will. His power finally manifested itself at the moment of his greatest need. He was given over to the assembly, where he survived training, but proved to be a magician of indifferent power and overall poor outlook. But that is not for this discussion. Your particular situation, the one that makes you somewhat of a problem for me, is that you are a barbarian. Excuse me, were a barbarian. Malamba smiled again. He had left the Tower of Testing with all his memories of his life, though much about his training was still sketchy. He understood the processes that had been used to bring him into control of his magic. They had singled him out as one among 100,000, a great one. Of the 200 million people of the Empire, he was one of 2,000 magicians of the Black Robe. His slave-bred wariness, as Hucho Pepper pointed out, combined with his intelligence to keep him silent. Hucho Pepper was trying to make a point, and Malamba would wait to hear what it was, no matter how roundabout the stout magician insisted on being. When Malamba said nothing, Hucho Pepper continued. Your position is strange for several reasons. The obvious one is that you are the first to wear the black who is not of this world. The second is that you were the apprentice of a lesser magician. Malamba raised an eyebrow. Kogan, you know of my training? Hucho Pepper laughed, a genuine belly laugh, which made Malamba relax his guard a little and regard the other man with a little less distrust. Of course. There was not one aspect of your background that was not closely examined, for you provided a wealth of information about your world. Hucho Pepper looked closely at his guest. The warlord might choose to launch an invasion into a world we know little about, over the objections of some of his magician advisers, I might add. But we of the assembly prefer to study our adversaries. We were most relieved to learn magic is restricted to the province of priests and followers of the lesser path on your world. Again you mention a lesser magic. What is your meaning? It was Hucho Pepper's turn to look slightly surprised. I assumed you knew. Malamba shook his head. The path of lesser magic is walked by some who can operate certain forces by power of will, though of a different order than we of the Black Robe. Then you know of my previous failure. Hucho Pepper laughed again. Yes. Had you been less suited to the greater path, you might have learned his ways. As it is, you had too much ability to have succeeded as a lesser path magician. It is a talent rather than an art, the lesser path. The greater path is for scholars. Malamba nodded. Each time Hucho Pepper explained a concept, it was as if Malamba had known it all his life. He remarked on this. It is easy enough to understand. During your training, many facts and concepts were taught you. The basic concepts of magic were taught early, your responsibility to the Empire later. Part of the process of bringing all your abilities to maturity requires that all these facts be there when you need them. But much of what you were taught was also masked, to be revealed when you needed it, when you could fully understand what was in your mind. There will be a period when thoughts will come unbidden from time to time. As you frame a question, the answer will appear in your mind. And sometimes an answer will come as you read it or hear it. It serves to keep you from reeling under the impact of years of learning coming upon you in an instant. It is not unlike the spells used to grant you the visions on the Tower of Testing. Obviously, we have no means to see what occurred before the time of the bridge, or at any other time in history. But we can plant suggestions, create illusion. Things are not what they seem. Melamba barely hid his surprise at this unexpected voice in his mind. And provide a construct around which you may add the images most significant to you. Personally, I find the entire presentation upon the tower reeks of grand opera. You may avail yourself of the libraries should you seek history rather than theater. Seeing Malamba's attentions were elsewhere, Hochepepe said, In any event, we were speaking of other things. Melamba said, I would hear of your problem. Hochepepe adjusted his robe, smoothing the creases. Indulge me a moment longer for a brief digression. It all has bearing on why I asked you here. Melamba signified that Hochepepe should continue. Little is known of our peoples before the escape. We know that the nations came from many different worlds. There is also some speculation that others fled the enemy to different worlds. Your former home world among them, perhaps. There are a few shreds of evidence to support that hypothesis. But it is only conjecture at this point. Melamba thought about the games of shore he had played with the Lord of the Shinzawe and considered the possibility. We came as refugees. Of millions, only thousands survived to plant seeds here. We found this world old and used up. Great civilizations once flourished here, and all that is left of them are worn, smooth stones where once cities stood. Who these creatures were, no one knows. This world has few metals, and what was brought with us in the escape wore away over the ages. Our animals, like your horses and cattle, died out, all save the dogs. We had to adjust to our new home world, and to each other. We fought many wars between the time of the escape and the advent of the stranger. We were little more than city-states until the Battle of 1,000 Ships. Then the humblest of the races, the Surani, rose to conquer all others, uniting most of this world in a single empire. We of the Assembly support the empire because on this world it is the single most powerful force for order, not because it is noble or fair or beautiful or just, but because of it the majority of humanity can live and work without war in their homelands, can live without famine, plagues, and the other disasters of older times. And with this order around us, we of the Assembly can work unhindered. It was the attempt to dispel the stranger that first made it apparent that we must be able to work unhindered by anyone, including the Emperor, with whatever resources are necessary. We were robbed of precious time for action by the Emperor's lack of cooperation when we first learned of the stranger. Had we been given support at once, we might have been able to deal with the enemy when it acted to warp the rift. That is why we accepted the charge to defend and serve the Empire, in exchange for total freedom. Melamba said, This is all apparent as you speak of it. I am still waiting to hear of your problem regarding me. Hochepepe sighed. In good time, my friend. I must finish one last thought. You must understand why the Assembly functions as it does to have any hope of surviving more than a few weeks. Melamba looked openly surprised at this remark. Survive? Yes, Melamba, survive. For there are many here who would have seen you at the bottom of the lake during your training. Why?
We worked to restore the greater art. When we fled the enemy at the dawn of history, only one magician in 1,000 who battled the enemy survived. They, for the most part, were the lesser magicians and apprentices. They banded together in small groups to protect the knowledge they brought with them from their homeworlds. At first, countrymen would seek out countrymen. Then, later, larger associations grew, as desire grew to restore the lost arts. After centuries had passed, the assembly was founded, and magicians from all parts of the world came. Until today, all who walk the greater path are members of the assembly. Most of those who practice the lesser art serve here as well, though they are afforded a different level of respect and freedom. They tend to be better at building devices and understanding the forces of nature than we of the black robes. They build the orbs we use to transport ourselves from place to place, for one example. While not outside the law, the lesser magicians are protected from interference from others by the assembly. All magicians are the province of the assembly. Melamba said, "So we gain freedom to act as we see fit, as long as we act in the best interest of the empire." Hojo Pepe nodded. "It does not matter what we do, or even that two magicians may find themselves at odds over some action or another, as long as both are working in what they believe is the best interest of the empire. From my somewhat barbaric point of view, a strange law. Not a law, but a tradition. On this world, my barbaric friend, tradition and custom can be a much stronger constraint than law. Laws are changed, but tradition endures." "I think I see what your problem is, my civilized friend. You are not sure if I will act in the best interest of the empire, being an outlander." Hojo Pepe nodded.
"Were we certain that you were capable of acting against the empire, you would have been killed. As it is, we are uncertain. Though we tend to believe it unlikely you are capable of such action."
For the first time, Melamba was completely unsure of what he was hearing.
"I was under the assumption that you had ways of ensuring that all who are trained are loyal to the empire, as the first duty."
"Normally, yes. In your case, we face problems new to us. As far as we can tell, you are submerged in the underlying cause of the Brotherhood of Magicians, the Order of the Empire. Usually we are certain. We simply read the apprentice's mind. With you, we couldn't. We had to rely on truth drugs, long interrogations, and training drills designed to show any duplicity."
"Why?"
"Not for any reason we understand. The spells of thought masking are known. It was nothing of that sort. It was as if your mind held some property we had never encountered before. Perhaps a natural talent unknown to us, but common to your world. Or the result of some training at the hands of your lesser path master protected you against our mind-reading arts. In any event, it created something of a stir in these halls, you may be sure. Several times during your training, the question of your continuing was raised. And each time our inability to read your mind was given as reason for your termination. Each time more were willing to see you continue than not. On the whole, you present a possible wealth of new knowledge and, as such, deserve every benefit of the doubt. To ensure we do not lose such a valuable addition to our storehouse of talents, of course."
"Of course," Melamba said dryly.
"Yesterday the question of your continuation became critical. When the time came for your final acceptance into the assembly, the issue was put to the vote and ended in a tie. There was one abstention, myself. As long as I remain unallied with one side or the other, the question of your survival is moot. You are free to act as a full member of the Assembly until I recast my vote to ratify your selection into the Assembly,
or not. Our tradition does not allow a change of vote, once cast, except abstentions. As no one absent during the voting may add their vote later, I am the only one who can break the tie. So the result of the voting, no matter how long delayed, is mine to decide. Melamba looked long and hard at the older magician.
I see.
Huchupepa shook his head slowly.
I wonder if you do.
To put it in its simplest form, the question of the moment is, what am I to do with you? Without meaning to, I find your life is now in my hands. What I have to decide is whether or not you should be killed. That is why I wish to see you, to see if I might have erred in judgment.
Suddenly Melamba threw back his head and laughed, long and hard. In a moment tears were running down his cheeks. When he quieted, Huchupepa said,
I fail to see the humor.
Melamba raised his hand in a placating gesture.
No offense was intended, my civilized